From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made earlier this month at a town hall meeting in Syracuse. A group of about 20 activists took the microphone to voice demands for police reform in the city. One of those activists was Yusuf Abdul-Qadir, director of the local chapter of the New York Civil Liberties Union. During his remarks, Abdul-Qadir addressed police residency, saying 95% of Syracuse Police Department officers do not live in the city of Syracuse. And that, he said, means the money used to pay them is leaving the city and tax dollars are moving away from the local economy. Abdul-Qadir said, quote, "We are funding for other people's communities to have the promise of the American dream while we are denying it in our community. We are actually funding the suburbs, both in our police departments and in our schools. We're telling black and brown people and poor people, you don't matter," end quote. Those remarks have gone kind of regionally viral, sparking conversation about residency requirements for police. Census data from 2006 to 2010 for 745 cities and towns shows that on average, 31% of police officers were residents of the cities and towns that they served. That means most officers in cities like Rochester and larger cities don't live where they serve. Is that harmful when it comes to how they do their jobs? Would officers living in the cities where they patrol lead to more culturally competent, diversified forces and better police-community relations? According to USA Today, no recent research shows residency requirements improve relations between officers and the residents they're sworn to protect, but many activists and proponents disagree. And in other cities like Philadelphia, here's Kenyatta Johnson, a member of Philadelphia City Council, who introduced a bill recently to restore the city's police residency requirement. She said, quote, "It's a plus if we have officers who live in the city, that grew up in the city, that have a stake in the city because it's home. It goes a long way to building community trust." So what's next here? Let's talk about that this hour with our guests who are on the line with us. Simeon Bannister is Vice President of Community Programs at the Rochester Area Community Foundation. Simeon, welcome back to the program.
Great to be with you, Evan.
Also with us is Kelly McNair. Kelly is co-lead of the Pathstone Foundation's Anti-Racism Curriculum Project. Kelly, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Shane Wiegand is also co-lead of that same project. Shane, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Evan.
And Danielle Ponder is Diversity and Inclusion Officer from the Monroe County Public Defender's Office. Danielle, welcome back to you.
Thank you.
Well, Simeon, this is something that you and I have had a conversation offline about a number of times here. But this seems to be the moment where there is more serious national attention in a lot of different cities on residency requirements. I could ask you why it matters, but then we'd have to set aside, you know, several hours. But can you encapsulate, I mean, there's a lot of different threads here. What are the different threads you see that matter when it comes to residency?
Yeah, there are a lot of different threads, Evan. But let's just start with, as a point of departure, the actual numbers. So in Rochester, we've calculated gross municipal product, a measure of economic activity in the city, at about $5.2 billion. Population of Rochester is a shade over 200,000. If you take the population of Monroe County without the city of Rochester, population is about 515,000, with economic activity at $43 billion. So just to be clear, that's 10 times the level of economic activity for double the population. So that already screams at us that there's a clear disparity that we need to be cognizant of. And then when we ask the question, how did we get that way? And I'm glad that Kelly and Shane are here to talk a little bit about our history. When we ask the question how we got that way and how is that system maintained, I look at our $87 million personnel budget for the police department, our $47 million personnel budget for fire, our $560 million personnel budget for teachers, 70% of whom amongst those groups, as you indicated at the outset, live in the suburbs. And by my math, that's nearly $500 million every single year that leaves the city of Rochester, funded by municipal taxpaying dollars, that end up out in outside of the city of Rochester. And that ultimately undermines the strength of the city. It undermines the equity of our region. And frankly, there's something that we can do about it.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what we can do. And Simeon, let me just follow that with you before I turn to the other guests here. You know, one of the things that I saw in response to what Yusuf Abdul-Qadir said in Syracuse, for example, some of the I would say opponents or skeptics are saying, well, you put that residency requirement in, all of a sudden 70% of the police force is gone overnight. What are you going to do? I'm not sure that that's exactly the mechanism, an immediate requirement, but would it be phased in? How do you see the mechanism actually working, Simeon?
Yeah, there's a number of different ways it could work. Let me just say this. This is like not new. Even George Washington back in 1796 said every matter and thing that relates to the city ought to be transacted therein, and the persons to whose care they are committed should be residents. That's George Washington talking about Washington, D.C. back in 1796. So this isn't new. It's not fringe. A lot of places around us, including Milwaukee, Chicago, Buffalo, Niagara County, and the city of Niagara, have experimented at one point or another with residency requirements. Other places have looked at commuter taxes, places like Cleveland and Philadelphia. The point here is to reclaim the revenue for the city so that those dollars can be invested, because the underlying premise here is that what we look at in a place like Rochester and so many places that are similar is community-wide deprivation. That this system has created an extractive economy that sucks dollars out of the city and displaces those dollars and leaves in its wake, again, widespread deprivation. And so there's a lot of different ways to get at this. I know that there are some folks that are talking about a public banking mechanism to bring dollars into the community and redistribute them in ways that are much more equitable and fair. Some folks have described a reparations-based approach that says that, hey, if we look at the history, we know that certain people, people of color in Rochester, have been disproportionately impacted, and so these resources, as they come back into the city, need to be distributed in a way that is ultimately impactful for folks that have been harmed by policies and decisions. Last thing I'll just say, and then pass it over to someone else here, but it's also important to know that this is not the laws of nature that have created this set of circumstances. You had Richard Rothstein on your show a while back who also noted this. This is not the way that things are, that there are policy decisions along the way that got us to this point. And so if policy decisions got us here, then that means that we can be decisive about policy options that help us to remediate some of these challenges.
Yeah, Simeon is talking about the book, The Color of Law, which, that's on that list of should be required reading for a lot of people right now in this moment. And I don't say that condescendingly. I mean, it was eye-opening for me. And we're going to talk to Kelly and Shane in just a moment about that history that Simeon talks about. Danielle Ponder, what do you see as a possible benefit of some kind of residency requirement? Or perhaps, as Simeon points out, there's different ways, different flavors of doing this, especially if what you're really after is making sure it's equitable for on the dollar side of things. I mean, commuter tax is an idea, et cetera. But what do you see as possible benefits of these ideas, Daniel?
Over the years, I've always talked to you about reforming. And I'd just like to acknowledge that over the past 3 months, the more I read, the more research I do, the less I'm a reformer when it comes to police. So I can't, maybe last year I would have said, yes, if we have more police who are from the community, they will be nicer to people and this, that, and the third. But then I did some research on, one, having more officers of color who are from the community. And what the data shows is that you actually have to get about over 40% before you see any actual impact. What happens when you bring in officers who are of color from the community, especially if they're in a low number, they tend to adapt the culture of the police department, and they also tend to treat residents worse because they feel like they almost have to prove to the white officers that they're down with the blue line. So I'm much more skeptical than I've been, just because, there's bodies of research out there that gives us that has informed my opinion, right? So I will say this: I do believe that if we are to have an emergency response team, or if we are to reimagine public safety, then those individuals who work in that system should be from the community, and I do believe that they should be majority people of color. But I don't think it's about getting a residence requirement with this current culture, with this current system of policing. I think we need to really rethink our system. So I want to connect this argument which I think USEF was doing as well, mm-hmm. was connecting it to the defunding argument. So this is, to me, is still about defunding. It's just not about, it's not about just changing a state law.
Yeah, and let me just follow up on that point then, because again, I think as we've talked about here and elsewhere, it matters to be as specific as we can when we use the word defund, especially when it comes to defunding police. Defund does not necessarily mean abolish all police, though it can in certain contexts. And I know that even in the activist community here, there's been a debate about that. Reverend Lewis Stewart on this program, Councilman Willie Lightfoot, they stated emphatically on this program, their belief is that the black community does not want no police, that they want a shift in how police are trained and in the quality of policing, but not no police. Have you moved on that at all? Where are you on that, Daniel Pundit?
So I would say that the black community is not a monolith.
Right,
I think
right.
Everybody, I know folks who are abolitionists. I know folks who just want, you know, the 50% cut. But what I believe is that I'm looking at the data and I want to make a data informed opinion. And what we know right now, and this is for throughout the country, is that the majority of arrests that police are making are for misdemeanor offenses. And we live in a country that has the highest incarceration rate in the world, right? We know that police are, for example, Project Exile. There's no data that program actually works. So I believe we keep doing the same thing that actually hasn't proven to be effective, but we expect some result. So I don't want to be emotional and say we need police just because it scares people to say we don't. But the data shows it's really not an effective way to curb crime. I think there definitely should be some type of emergency response team. I don't know if that's officers. I don't know if that's civilians. I don't know if that's people who are trained in the community. But definitely there should be an emergency response team. But I guarantee you they shouldn't come at the tune of $100 million. So I guess where I am right now is that the current system does not work. If I could snap my finger, I would disband the whole Rochester Police Department and I would start over with a new system to deal with public safety.
Kelly, can I start by asking you to describe what the Anti-Racism Curriculum Project is?
Sure. The Anti-Racism Project gives the history of what's called redlining, and Shane will get into that in more specifics because those are the policies that both Simeon and Danielle referred to that are keeping things the way that they are. But the anti-racism curriculum is designed to teach students about redlining through the use of primary source documents, articles, newspaper articles, microfiche documents, and documents that are real, tangible pieces of evidence that come from the history of our city, really, and allows them through an inquiry-based model to investigate those primary source documents and come up with some conjectures of their own and some conclusions of their own. And the one thing that is really important and nice about it is that it does structure it in a way that allows kids the opportunity to investigate those historical documents, ask questions about them, and then make some decisions about action. Like, what do we need to do now as kids, as a community, as people, whether they be people of color or white students in the curriculum? It allows them to take some action moving forward.
Okay. Shane, you want to add to that?
Definitely. Thanks so much, Kelly. I think a big thing that we want to do is highlight this long history of disinvestment from particularly redlined neighborhoods of the inner city. In the way, as Rothstein talked so eloquently about in your program last year with The Color of Law, the way the federal government, through the 1934 National Housing Act, invested over $120 billion into the white communities building the suburbs. So suburbs like Pittsburgh in 1940 had around 9,000 residents. And by 1960, they'd grown to over 50,000, largely through FHA and VA mortgages that were exclusive and limited only to white folks. And so we want to show kids data like that from the Barrow Architecture Report on Pittsburgh that highlights that. But we want to put it in the context through our inquiry model of giving them a source like the 1958 New York State Commission Against Discrimination that highlights that in the inner city, in the 3rd and 7th wards, red line neighborhoods, that's where 80% of all Monroe County people of color lived, which is pretty similar to still today. And then we want to also put that into the context of that report that showed that not a single African American received a GI or FHA loan to buy a house in any of Monroe County's suburbs. So we want kids to see the facts and give them the tools to think critically about those facts. And then through restorative practices and restorative peace circles, we want to teach kids how to talk about this history, to talk about race, racism, and how to be anti-racist and learn from the examples of the folks like Howard Coles, who in 1938 ran the Frederick Douglass Voice and did like the landmark housing study in Rochester, finding that real estate agents were steering African Americans into those two red line neighborhoods, that banks were working together as well as the heads of the building association, the heads of the real estate boards, and the banks were collaborating on these processes. We want kids to sort of see that, see how people like Coles resisted, people like Dr. Walter Kupel, Alice Young, Peter Tolliver, and so many others. And then also make that link. In June, after the killing of George Floyd, my fourth graders were really confused. They wanted to understand what was going on and why were people protesting. And so we showed them maybe what was the first Black Lives Matter protest, not called that in Rochester, but in 1962, after Rufus Farewell, a man of color, locking up his gas station that he owned in the Red Lion neighborhood on Columbia and Plymouth Avenue. He was brutally beaten by a group of white police officers. And Reverend Gibson from Memorial AME, with Rufus Farewell, they led a march of protest on City Hall demanding justice. And this was one of the inciting incidents of the uprising in 1964. And all of that, I think, is directly linked back to people of color being forced into these two very specific neighborhoods because of federal, state, and local policies, and then being that creating the environment and space for over-policing of those neighborhoods and police being used to enforce that residential segregation. And I could go on and on and talk about racial restrictive covenants, but I'll stop there for now. I think that's a basis of where we want to go.
I've got a number of comments from listeners, and Louise in Rochester, please stay on the line. I just want to follow up with Kelly for one moment, and then we'll get to some listener feedback as we talk about possible residency requirements. We're thinking about police, and we're thinking about a lot of the history involved to how we got to this point. Kelly, how do you see the debate about residency requirements and policing impacted by the history? You know, how do you connect what you're working on in this project to the current debate?
Well, I think the residency requirements just would help, would allow people to feel that the people that are serving them in the police force are people that they know, people that care about them, people that know their families, people that know their names, know who they are, and are connected to them in a way that people who are policing from outside of a particular sector or given geographical location within the city are not connected. So you have people who are not connected in that to that degree of intimacy with people that they are policing. There has to be a community relationship. I know for Monroe County, anyways, there is a guideline that you, if you're a Monroe County sheriff, you have to live in Monroe County. But that's a wide, you know, reaching range. It's not the same as what we're talking about here with policing, community peace policing to that extent, where you really, really have that up close, impersonal knowledge of the community.
Talking to Kelly McNair and Shane Wiegand, who are co-leads of the Pathstone Foundation's Anti-Racism Curriculum Project, and Daniel Ponder from the Monroe County Public Defender's Office, Simeon Bannister from the Rochester Area Community Foundation, as we discuss what residency requirements might mean to this community and how they might work. And let me get a little bit of listener feedback on this subject, starting with Louise in Rochester. Go ahead, Louise.
Thank you. I want to say that the police department is... the city police department is its own entity. Hypothetically, Evan, if you were a certified accountant and you took your civil service exam and you scored in the top three and you were getting canvassed and you were bilingual, trilingual, the perfect fit for our city accountant, and you lived in Fairport, you would not get that job. You would not. But the city police department can live in other places and get that position. And I also want to take it one step further to our judges, who also do not have to live in the city of Rochester. I don't know if the clerk staff with the police department, you know, public safety wing and courts and police department, their clerks have to live in the city. I don't want to pretend to know that. They may have to, because that's all civil service exam. But somebody that could be a perfect fit has to live in the city. And I feel like the police department needs to be held up, and the judges, to that standard as well. And I want to thank you for this program. You always have wonderful programs, and I especially want to thank Ms. Ponder for her extreme integrity. Thank you, Evan.
You got it, Louise. Thank you. I'll let Danielle Ponder, who, after, as soon as you stop blushing, you can respond to that, Danielle Ponder.
I was just going to say that city court judges do have to live in the city, and county court judges have to live in the county. But, I, you know, just going back to Youssef's remarks, and what I hope doesn't get lost is I think black folks are asking for the agency and the finances to deal with our own problems. And for too often, and it's not only in the police department, and talking with Simeon has really enlightened me, not to like put you on the spot, Simeon,
no
but
doubt.
It's really enlightened me a lot and to even looking at the nonprofit sector and looking at the school district and looking at almost every area, as he said, where money is continuously leaving the city. But what's really sad about it is this: the money that is going into these nonprofits or into the police department, whatever, are supposed to fix black problems, right? And instead of hiring black people to fix those problems, we continuously outsource. So how do we change the dynamics where we have health workers or an emergency response team or whatever it might be from the community? And then what type of economic impact will that have now that we are paying young black men and women or whatever age, black men and women? What if they were getting the six-figure salaries that the officers are getting? So I think all the time about the CNAs who are making $11 an hour and are working double shifts and their kids are left unattended. And, you know, the officer will arrest their kid and tell their kid, tell this CNA how bad their children are and how they need to take better care of their kids. But if that woman had the six figures that that officer had, her son wouldn't be in that situation most likely. So to me, it's about shifting the money back into the community and letting black folks solve our problems with our own resources and have our own agency.
Simeon, you want to follow up on what Danielle and Louise said there?
I do. I think that's exactly it. I mean, when we look at I find myself in a lot of conversations and a lot of meetings about what we should do, about how we should, you know, solve the problems of poverty, how we should wrestle with the challenges of education and so on and so forth. And what if the actual problem, right, is the dollars that are leaving the city? What if the actual problem is that we have a city that is largely under-resourced? There's a trope that's going around that Rochester is resource-rich. I don't know about the city of the county, but I know that the city of Rochester is not resource-rich because the numbers bear it out, right? Because the numbers tell us that of the $5.2 billion in economic activity, $3 billion. We got this from the Institute for Poverty Studies and Economic Development over at SUNY Brockport. $3 billion is leaving the community every single year if you throw in the private sector, if you throw in the nonprofit sector and others. What if that's actually the root of the problem? And the fact of the matter is that I think we can kind of trace some of that, can't we? Like, can't we wrap our heads around the idea that as those dollars flow out, that there's no market that's sustained in the city? Can't we wrap our heads around the notion that if there's no market and then no commerce, then there are no job opportunities? Can't we wrap our heads around this idea that if there are no commercial activities and there are no job opportunities, then folks have to figure out how to get by? That maybe that's the part of the root of crime in the city of Rochester, that folks have to figure out how to make it. And if that's the case, then when I will inevitably expect that someone will call here and say, what about those white families? That maybe part of the reason is that those families are under-resourced, and so that undermines the ability to build stable, strong households. And so the real opportunity for us here is to think about doing this a different way. Danielle said it right. And I also want to give a shout out to my sister, Rena Golden, over on Joseph Avenue, doing this work. That doing the same thing over and over and over again that we know is not effective can't then present the solution. We've got to do something different. We've got to think differently about the problem. And the fact is that the history bears it out.
So can I just follow on that point real briefly before I've got so much listener feedback already. You've all really sparked a lot of thought in the community already on this issue. To Danielle's point about what the research indicates, I think it might surprise some listeners to hear that at least some of the preliminary research about residency requirements finds there isn't necessarily a correlative impact on police-community relations. Now, I haven't seen every study. I haven't seen how they're designed. And research, I mean, look, we all want bigger sample sizes, more time. It's complex. I mean, Kelly and Shane will probably explain it even in more detail about why this is complex, and maybe a single study doesn't give you everything you need to know about that. But to Danielle's point, when we buy into, well, this reform will fix everything, well, this reform will fix everything, it doesn't quite work that way, and maybe a full-scale reimagining is what's happening. Now, before that happens, Simeon, to your point, maybe a commuter tax, maybe just being direct about, hey, you can police here, but if you don't live here, we'll ask you to pay a commuter tax because otherwise we're talking millions, if not billions of dollars, go to the suburbs. If we're going to do a commuter tax, is it as simple as saying that? Say, hey, 70% of our officers who don't live in the city of Rochester, hey, so we're going to tax you X amount. What's it look like? I mean, what's sort of fair or reasonable?
So I think if I can, your listeners might be Googling and seeing an article that was in USA Today that proved this question, that it at least attempts to argue that there isn't a connection between community relations, right? And so if folks read that, they're going to see a link in that story to a paper by a guy named Professor Isinger out of Wisconsin. I just want to quote from it really quickly, where he says, tax revenues that may be collected from municipal employees, to say nothing of the salary money spent in the local private sector for goods and services, assume non-trivial proportions for cities that must collect every dollar. We have also seen that the distillation of the labor pool achieved by eliminating metropolitan workers from the competition for public jobs theoretically enhances the prospects for central city minority job applicants. That's really the upshot of this, right, is, again, how do you drive revenue back where we have sectors that are totally under-resourced? What COVID-19 is showing us is that in our nonprofit spaces, we are under-resourced to be able to deal with the Herculean challenges that are presented. And the basis of those challenges is a structurally racist history. And that's the key point here. This isn't arbitrary. This isn't a capricious notion of a commuter tax. That it redresses a historical wrong that was committed, and it provides the resources to create agency in the community. And that's a critical piece of this, and losing it kind of loses the point.
Okay. Let's get our only break of the hour. And if you're on the phone, if you've emailed, we've got a lot to work through, a lot of really interesting, thoughtful ideas and concerns, questions shared by our listeners as we talk about residency requirements in the city of Rochester for police and the debate that's being held in many cities across the country. Let's take that break and come right back on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, as the pandemic continues, could the United States Congress be moving in the direction of a UBI, a universal basic income, a monthly payment, not a one-time $1,200, but a monthly payment to all or most Americans? Yesterday, Congressman Joe Morelli on this program said that he's thinking hard about it. His mind is changing. What about other members of Congress? What could the impact be on your life? We'll talk about it next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. So let's work through some more listener questions and comments about this and related subjects. I'm going to get Chris in Greece next. Go ahead, Chris.
Hi. I think the conversation has shifted, but I was responding to the redlining comments earlier. I just wanted to share that my mom was born in 1919, and in 1929, when the stock market crashed, they moved to Sioux City, Iowa, into a very poor section of town right next to black families. By the time she was married and bought a house with my dad in 1956, there was a covenant put on the deed that only white people could buy our house. We discovered this when my dad died in 2014. None of us knew this at all. This was done by government decree. This wasn't something natural. This just happened by government.
Kelly McNair,
I'd like to respond to that.
Yeah, Kelly and Shane, I'm sure that's I'll let Kelly start. I'm sure that is no surprise. Go ahead, Kelly.
I'm going to let Shane take that one.
Okay, yeah, Shane, go ahead.
Yeah, so thank you so much for that comment about racially restrictive covenants. In fact, as part of City Roots Community Land Trust in the Yale Environmental Protection Clinic, we're actually releasing a report at the end of July about racially restrictive covenants in Rochester. We've chronicled thousands of these covenants in every single inner ring suburb. Neighborhoods like Meadowbrook and Brighton have covenants written into the deeds that say no person of color can ever live there. And these were being enforced up until 1968. The 19th Ward, Beechwood neighborhoods, Browncroft neighborhoods, Winton Lee neighborhoods, almost all of Northwest Irondequoit, where actually Walter Wegman of the Wegman family, his home had one of these racial deed restrictions in it, as did thousands of other people in Greece, in Gates, Webster, Penfield. In fact, one thing that I think is particularly relevant is the Indian Landing Elementary School. There was a story in the DNC just the other day about a student of color, youth of color, being the police called on him because he was coming to just play basketball with his coach and was perceived as a threat. And it's interesting, and one of the things we highlight in our curriculum is that schools like Indian Landing held annual blackface minstrel shows where they would mock the intelligence of people of color all the way up to late 1950s and 60s. Every single spring they'd have these shows. And then right next to door to Indian Landing Elementary, all the homes in that Ellison Park neighborhood have those racial deed restrictions barring people of color from living there, which were enforced by judges and then the police. And so policing and racial segregation has always kind of been connected with these federally mandated policies like racially restrictive covenants, that people from the head of the Builders Association, Norman Huck, to the head of the real estate agency or real estate board, Frank Drum, were responsible for making sure people towed the line and enforced these throughout our community.
Hmm. Chris, do you want to follow on that?
No, I just think it's a tragedy. This didn't have to happen. You know, we were already integrated, at least poor people were integrated in the 1920s, and we've just screwed everything up. That's all I have to say.
I think that's a great point. The 3rd and 7th Wards were integrated neighborhoods, up through the 40s even. And then with redlining, people were given access, who were white, to buy homes in the suburbs, whereas people of color weren't. And it led to disinvestment and then segregation in those neighborhoods, and really changed the makeup of our city, forced by the government.
Chris, thank you for the phone call. Let me get a couple of comments before I get back to your phone calls. A couple of comments have come in with questions online include the following. Chris says, a different Chris, he says, my question is, we've seen people skirt residency requirements by keeping their house, for example, in Mendon and just renting a cheap apartment within the city. Can't we find ways to make it attractive to live where you work instead of a legal requirement? And he says, if the only incentive about all of this is money, why not just pay a lower salary to an officer who lives outside of the city? Simeon Bannister, you want to respond to those remarks?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple different ways to do it. That's an interesting notion. I think what it really comes down to, though, when it's all said and done, is that this really is about money. This is about the underlying economics. I mean, I think that's really the driver. It's certainly the case that we want to be cognizant of the residency trends, but that's why I think some folks have even promoted a commuter tax that basically says if you come into the city and you work and you leave, that you leave some of that revenue behind. The real question is, what do we do with that revenue, right? Do we just use it for general operating, or do we take those dollars and point them directly where the challenges have been in this community, again, around race? And you just heard what Shane described. I'm excited that this community is finally starting to have some meaningful conversations. I'm excited about this new commission to talk about structural racism, but let's talk about the structural dynamic here. Let's be clear that echo from those decisions that Kelly and Shane were just describing continues to reverberate all the way to the present moment, where folks have been disinvested and not had resources. And let's also be clear that it was explicitly racist policies that created that set of circumstances. So our response to that can't be racially opaque policies, right? Because they don't solve for the way that this challenge emerged in the first place. which means that we've got to do something different. And it's going to take a little bit of courage in this community. We're going to have conversations a little differently than we had, and we're going to take actions a little different than we have. And if we are not prepared to do that, then we can't really pretend like we're talking seriously about structural racism and really dealing with issues of equity.
Okay. Well, on that subject, Eva says, how about school teachers being required to live in the city as well? Who else should be required to live in the city? I am all for this. And Todd follows up saying, does this apply to all city employees or just police? Why or why not? Will we require folks who live in the city to send their children to city schools? The mayors currently do not go to city schools.
Actually, if you don't mind, I just want to jump in on that one, because I actually think that that's a really interesting point. So if you are a child that lives on Joseph Avenue, you can't just pick up and go to school in Pittsford if you're so inclined. In fact, if you attempted to do so, your parents would be arrested for theft of services. So there's a kind of a weird discrepancy here where anybody can come into the city and work, but kids certainly can't go out and get their educational needs met anywhere around the community. So I just, you know, I want to point out that that tension. I also would like to point out that, you know, ultimately there are, just so that we're all clear, the state law, the Public Officers Law, Section 3, currently prohibits police offices, firefighters, and other uniformed services from residency requirements. Of course, laws can be changed, and so we, you know, certainly lead with that. But in the case of the teachers, that's actually an action that's created by the local Board of Education. There's a home rule. And in fact, over in Buffalo, they've had and not had. They've kind of gone back and forth on residency requirements. All actions taken by the local school board. The same thing is true. Niagara, the city of Niagara is actually going through that process now of having that debate. So that's an action that could happen here locally. Tonight's a Thursday. I don't know if there's a board meeting tonight, but they could do it tonight if they were so inclined.
Kelly and Shane, do you have an issue with teachers living in this community or not?
I would say I don't have any. Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead, Kelly.
I was just going to say I don't have an issue with teachers. I see what people are saying here. It's really the same concept, right? You want people from the community that they're serving to be a part of that community. I remember years ago there was a program called the Officer Next Door Program, and there was also one called the Teacher Next Door Program, where it offered teachers and officers reduced rates to buy houses in certain areas of the city. There were some ramifications around that, where you could be a teacher in any school district and have that reduced rate that they're buying a house in the city. But still, the idea being that there's a teacher who lives in that community who is someone that kids and families would look up to, would be able to relate to, and build community, build a sense of community with. I think the idea behind that is a good one. I don't know the answer to how to do that the most effective way and make sure that, you know, the dollars that, like Simeon's talking about, the resources and the dollars are staying in the community.
Okay, Shane?
And I can definitely agree with that. But I think that what we really want to do with our curriculum is we want kids to be a part of this conversation of how we build a more equitable Rochester. It shouldn't just be the adults like us sitting here and having this important conversation. Kids need to be equipped with the historical context and understanding about the things in our community and shown the respect and just the belief in them that we know they can have this conversation, because oftentimes it is our youth, especially of color, that are going to be the most directly impacted by these sort of policies and decisions. And I think so often we don't find a way to create that space or even teach kids how to be a part of these conversations. And that's a big part of what we want to do.
All right. Let me get Jane in Rochester next on the phone. Hi, Jane.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
Good. I feel a little bit differently on this issue than your panel there. I feel like... Well, just like your guests who are black, they want to live where they want to live. And I think that should be that the police should live where they want to live. Now, personally, I would not want to live in a neighborhood and be a policeman. I would fear that I would not be objective. If this person's my friend and another person's my friend and we get things going, he said, she said, I just wouldn't want that. I would want somebody out of the situation totally. Let's see, what else did I have to say? Also, I think the police, if you're going to do anything, they should be at the table with you. That's the way we do everything else, ideally, is we have all people affected at the table to have a good hearing. So that is how I feel. Evan?
Okay.
Jane,
thank you. What do you think, Simeon Bannister?
The courts actually affirmed that people do have a constitutional right to live anywhere they want, but what they don't have is a constitutional right to public employment. And so I just think we just need to be clear about that. I also just say Sugarman v. Dougal, Kennedy versus the City of Newark, Abraham versus the Civil Service Commission. What we're talking about here are things that have been affirmed by the courts under two theories. One theory is the stake in the community doctrine, which Kelly has kind of alluded to, this idea that if people have a stake in the community, that they can make a significant contribution and that the quality of the service that they provide is enhanced. The other is the public coffer theory, and that's the notion of mutual support between the city and its employees, and this idea that a municipality, frankly, has the right to ensure that if it's putting dollars out, that those dollars are being spent in a way that benefit the municipality itself. And so, like I said, I appreciate her point. I do think that, you know, anytime there's opportunities for communicative conversations and to bring people together, we should avail themselves of those. But let's also be clear that the history here wasn't all that communicative, right? It's not like how it always is, frankly. Yeah. The way that we got to this set of circumstances is because it was exclusionary. And so it seems to me that the opportunity here is to do something different.
Yeah, and Danielle, given the work that you've done over the years in public defending, you know, Jane's concerned that she says if she were a police officer and living in the place where she knew people and serving in that same place, she wouldn't trust herself to be objective. So she's actually turning the concern differently. But I think, you know, citing the research and the history that Simeon just did, I am more compelled to think, Danielle, that we do want people who do want a stake in the community. And I think that would maybe outweigh any concern that a police officer couldn't be objective. But what do you think, Danielle Ponder?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure how to even read that question. You know, I think about officers who live in small towns and who live in the suburbs and how that objectivity is actually powerful because it allows them to do holistic things, right? It allows them to say, hey, I know your father who lives down the street, I'm going to drive you home. You know, it allows them to say, I'm going to talk to your mother, or, you know, I've worked in small towns, so I kind of see how town officers interact a little differently with the people that they police. So I don't think that objectivity is necessarily a bad thing. I'm not quite sure I get what point that she was trying to make.
Jane, I would just say I understand why judges recuse themselves when they know somebody or they're overly familiar with the particulars in a certain case. I don't necessarily know that it's the same for police who are simply serving in a community that they already invested in and have more of a stake in. I hear the concern. I don't know that it's apples to apples there. Let me read an email from Leah with a question directly for Danielle Ponder, because Danielle, she's referencing some of the comments Danielle made earlier. And Leah says, did I delete it, Leah? I think what Leah is asking, it's real time. It's great hosting. Here it is. She says, for Danielle, I'm all for letting black people solve black problems, as Danielle described it earlier in the show. But what does that look like on its feet? Which problems are black? What makes them that? I believe racism is systemic, by the way. And she just wants more of an understanding on those comments. That's from Leah. Danielle Ponder.
Yeah, I think, you know, that Rochester is 44. The city of Rochester, Simeon could give you, I may be wrong about this stat, but I know it's over 40% African-American.
It is, yeah.
And once again, the majority of people who work inside of these communities are not folks of color, right, who work in the nonprofit policing school district are not folks of color. So So in my opinion, we look at, you know, the historical trauma that Black people have experienced. We should be given the agency and the resources to heal that trauma. We look at the historical economic inequality that Black people have experienced. We should be given the charge and we should be given the resources to fix that issue. We look at issues of violence, shooting violence within our community. We should be given the agency and the resources to fix that issue. So I don't think there's anything radical with what I'm saying, but I just believe that, I guess those are the list of issues that I'm thinking about when I say we should have the resources to work on our own issues.
Well, let me ask all of you to kind of offer your thoughts about where this is going next here, because as I said at the outset, you could look at Philadelphia, Syracuse, this conversation obviously happening in Rochester, but you can pick many cities across the country that are looking at residency requirements, commuter taxes, some ways to keep more of the revenue in cities, not just let it escape to suburbs, and look at the impact of having police forces that are mostly composed of officers who don't live in those communities. This happened in a lot of places. Simeon, talk is one thing. If this becomes a year of action, what's required next? What do you think is or is likely to or needs to happen?
Yeah, I think number one, at least so far as the public education system goes, the school board is the foci in terms of decision making. As I said, that's a fairly straightforward opportunity. And then, you know, we've got a new state delegation, and so we'll see what they do with respect to some of these issues. And hopefully we bring some creativity and some imagination to what our community can be. One other thing I just don't want to get lost is that Danielle hit the nail on the head in terms of the quality of programming, but it's also the case that the quantity of dollars, everybody that's getting a paycheck that leaves the city of Rochester are dollars that could have gone to someone who's been disenfranchised historically. And so ultimately, at least you know, part of this is just about keeping the actual dollars, the actual paychecks, in the hands of folks that have been, you know, that have had disparity visited on them generationally. And I think that's really where the opportunity is. And we know that the irony of making sure that we have a more equitable situation is that it actually benefits really the entire region. That when you do things like not incarcerate folks, that you provide the education, that you fully fund the resources that contribute, that it actually creates a much more balanced tax system, and it creates a community that, again, is more equitable, more fair, and ultimately more vibrant. And we are seeing that around the country, that there's a correlation between places that are embracing those kinds of practices and folks that have had robust recoveries, like, for example, from the 2008 recession. Urban Institute has a report on that.
Okay. Daniel Ponder, about a minute, if you could, in your remarks here. You've pointed out that that maybe this needs to be a build-from-the-ground-up situation, not just sort of small-scale reform with a hope for sort of magical change that hasn't come with past reforms. Who do you see as most responsible for getting these changes made, as challenging as they may be?
I think city council and the mayor.
That was fast.
I've just been talking about this a lot.
Yeah.
They either need to get rid of the contract that they currently have with the police union and start all over, or they need to drastically cut the police department and invest that money back into the community. The mayor and city council are the folks who can make, in regards to residence requirement, obviously that's a state issue, but when I look at our police department, those are the people I'm looking at.
Kelly McNair, I'm down to about our last minute here. As you continue with your work in anti-racism curriculum, what do you think that is, you know, sort of the community role here, or how do you see the work that you're doing impacting these policy discussions, Kelly?
Yeah, I think it will have an impact on the policy discussions. I think continuing to have the conversations that we're having in schools, both with teachers and with students, will impact this community conversation. Just providing the resources and the information to families as well as to students to have them be an equitable voice in all of this is something that I think will be important moving forward.
In 30 seconds, Shane Wiegand, final thoughts from you. Go ahead.
final thoughts are, I grew up in Webster. I never had a black teacher. I sat next to one or two students of color my whole school experience. I didn't learn about redlining or racial deed restrictions or school segregation. I didn't even realize I lived in a segregated community. But I feel hope that we're starting to talk about these things. We're trusting kids that they can handle these conversations, to talk about policing, to talk about residency, and in general, just to talk about how can we build a more just and equitable Greater Rochester. And if you want to learn more about our work, you can go to pathstone.foundation.
Pathstone.foundation. It's the Anti-Racism Curriculum Project, and Shane and Kelly are the co-leads there. Shane and Kelly, thanks for making time for the program today.
Thank you, Evan.
Daniel Ponder, as always, thanks for the time, Danielle. Always good to talk to you.
Okay, thank you so much, Evan.
And Simeon Bannister, the Vice President of Community Programs at the Rochester Area Community Foundation. Hope to see you soon. Thanks for making time for the program.
You know it, man, and it's good to talk with you.
Simeon Bannister, been talking about this for a long time. We will see. But now, listeners, you got a better sense for this issue at this critical moment in this community debate. More connections coming up next.